I'm a very research-oriented person, and so as a young person, I wasn't the kind of person who thought I wanted to go to protests. But what I've learned by seeing these fights play out is that they are so powerful. So I think that what Sunrise has done is broken open the climate movement to be more about confrontational politics and not just inside baseball polite policymaking that, quite frankly, will not get us where we need to go.
Welcome back to Generation Green New Deal. 1 week ago, we had an election, and I hope everyone has recovered from the multi-day nail-biting hangover that it became. Today, we've got a special Gen G&D conversation with UC Santa Barbara Professor of Political Science, Leah Stokes. Leah is the co-host of the new climate podcast, Matter of Degrees, and the author of the book Short-Circuiting Policy. She's written a lot of really important work on climate policy and politics. I think one reason her story is interesting is she's a young academic who has deliberately stepped out of the stance that's been so prevalent in academia of needing to be a quote-unquote neutral objective observer and into advocacy. And as you'll hear, she started out skeptical of climate protests and certainly not as someone who saw herself as an activist. Now she encourages students who worry about climate change to join groups like Sunrise. And one of those students was Nikayla Jefferson, who we heard in our first Gen G&D conversation episode. Our producer Nate Birnbaum spoke with Leah about her journey embracing activism and confrontational politics, the impact of Sunrise and the Green New Deal on the climate movement, and her reaction to what last week's election means for the climate. Nate and Leah's conversation is coming up right after the break. Look, we get it. Keeping up with the flood of news every day can be stressful. There are updates on the coronavirus, the fallout of the election, policing, and questions like, will there be an NBA bubble part two? That's why Crooked has a daily news podcast called What a Day. It's hosted by comedian Akilah Hughes and politics reporter Gideon Resnick. Each day, they break down the biggest news stories, help you understand what matters and how you can fix it, all under 20 minutes. New episodes of What a Day come out every morning, Monday through Friday at 4 a.m. Eastern. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Leah Stokes, and I'm assistant professor in political science at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background? You studied psychology, is that right?
Yeah, in this new book that just came out called All We Can Save, I have an essay where I talk about how I first got into climate and energy research, which was as a psychology major in my undergrad at the University of Toronto. And at that time, I was running these individual behavior change campaigns where we were trying to get people to save energy and, you know, take the stairs rather than the elevator and turn off the lights and live more sustainably, those kinds of things. And at the end of that experience, I really realized that it wasn't a big enough lever, that if we wanted to change our society fast enough to deal with the climate crisis, we had to look to government policy. So if you want to take a train somewhere in this country rather than flying, oftentimes the train doesn't even exist. Or if it does, it will take you days to get there because the train service is not great and there's not good connections. And so I started to realize that the government sets the rules that all of us live within. And so if we want to have a low carbon society, we can't just, you know, purify our own lives. We actually need to change the system and the structures that allow us to choose in the first place.
That framing right off the bat kind of seems very in line with what the Green New Deal is all about.
The Green New Deal has taken us away from really a politics of sacrifice and costs around climate change. For so long, we've really been framing this as an issue of, you know, not paying for carbon pollution. So we need a price on carbon and, you know, we just need to have people pay for pollution. And I think that that framing is not helpful to presenting opportunity for action, opportunity for job growth, for equality, for sharing the wealth of society.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that translates into your academic work?
I'm a climate academic, and I'm even more than that. I'm an advocate and an activist at this point. And I don't know how you look at this crisis and don't ask yourself, how can I do more? How can I make a difference in this moment? It's not enough to just publish papers and hope that in a decade you make a difference, because in a decade, the planet will be a lot warmer. So I'm very focused not just on doing my research, which is very important. And I, of course, do that with independence and integrity and all the training and skills that I have. But I'm also interested in making sure that that research makes an impact now and supporting activists in their work with evidence. So I'm not planning on just hanging out in my academic quarters. I am going to get involved in this fight because I am also a young person. I have seen climate change in my own backyard. I've been evacuated from my home for weeks on end because of wildfires that are caused by climate change. I've seen people in my community die because of an extreme precipitation event that led to mudslides, again, linked to climate change. And so I can't watch people die and lose their homes and lives in my community and not do anything about it. I feel really strongly that I have seen climate change in my own life and I have to act and do something about it.
As you know, we had one of your students, Nikayla Jefferson, on our show for our first Gen GND conversation. And she told us a story about sitting up in the eighth floor of a library at UCSB and looking out and seeing on one side of the mountains smoke billowing, and on the other side over the ocean, bright orange-red sky from the Thomas Fire. And she was working on a Spanish final in one tab and monitoring the progress of the Thomas Fire in another tab. And that sounded pretty surreal. I'm just curious, what was your experience of the Thomas Fire like as a professor and as a resident of Santa Barbara?
Yeah, the Thomas Fire was a really big catalytic moment for my life and career as well. It happened right at the end of our quarter, and the students were right about to finish their exams. And I was teaching statistics at that time, and all my students find that quite a stressful class, and they had this final coming up. And every day, the air quality would get worse. It was really horrendous. And I ended up being evacuated from my home for 3 weeks because the fire burned for a very long time, over a month. And the air quality was just terrible for weeks on end. We spent weeks living in a hotel room with our cat. And when I came back in January, my exam got rescheduled for my students. And the day that the exam happened, several people couldn't make it because the night before we had had an extreme precipitation event increased by climate change, which led half an inch of rain to fall in 5 minutes in Montecito. And because the fire had scarred the landscape, it led to mudslides and almost 20 people died. And some students didn't get to write their exam that day. And we had just all been evacuated from our homes. We'd all just come back. A lot of people didn't leave their homes that night because they had been warned to some degree that there was a risk. And people didn't leave their homes because they had been out of their homes for weeks on end and they were exhausted by the fires. And there were helicopters flying back and forth all day long, you know, trying to find people in the mud. It was horrible, really horrible. And I woke up and I wrote that day an op-ed that ran in the New York Times called Climate Change in My Backyard. And it was about how what I am living through is climate change and about how we need the media to talk about climate change because people have to understand that these fires, these extreme rainfall events, these hurricanes, these heat waves, these things that are killing people right now, they are climate change. And that article that I wrote really catalyzed a whole new part of my career, which is doing a lot of public writing, public speaking, media, this new podcast that I'm launching called A Matter of Degrees. It really turned me into a public scholar in a way that I wasn't before. And one thing that I wrote in that article was that we need people to understand that they are climate change victims, because we know from political science research that when people see themselves as victims, they're more likely to become involved politically. You might think that being a victim of a crime makes you less likely to get involved, but that's not true. Think about the Black Lives Matter movement. So many people who are involved in that fight have lost family members through police violence against Black lives. And so the same can be true of the climate movement. Think about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She watched her own family in Puerto Rico live through Hurricane Maria. And that is something that she talks about being one of the reasons why she's a climate activist. So I think that we have to understand that climate change is happening in our lives now. And so once you understand the crisis that we face, you know, what I hope is that people turn towards organizing, activism, opportunity.
It seems like the people at organizations like Sunrise, they really understand that, and they've been very effective at influencing politicians.
Yeah. Well, confrontational politics are not easy, right? They work, they're effective, but it's not easy. It's not easy to show up to Nancy Pelosi's office, a woman who, quite frankly, actually passed the Waxman-Markey bill through the House, somebody who has been a climate leader in many ways. It's not easy to show up to her office and say, hey, we know this is hard, but we need you to do more for our future. It's not a very popular thing to do. I can't imagine that Nancy Pelosi liked it. It's not very easy to show up at Dianne Feinstein's office and say, hey, you need to do more. These kinds of confrontations with politicians are difficult, and they require a lot of backbone, and they can backfire. And so, you know, taking these kinds of risks is not easy. But I think there is power in a diverse youth voice. Think about the DAPL protests and all the indigenous groups that were focused on confronting power. That isn't easy to do. You have to put your body on the line in the case of the DAPL protests. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went to Standing Rock. She was part of that. So these confrontational approaches that are really hard bring in new people. They build power for the movement. They give people something to fight over that is tangible, that makes the stakes for real people clear. And I remember when the Keystone XL pipeline fight started, I didn't fully understand it. I'm a very research-oriented person. And so as a young person, I wasn't the kind of person who thought I wanted to go to protests, or I didn't really understand what's the point in stopping one pipeline. But what I've learned by seeing these fights play out is that these symbolic, visible fights that are place-based, that are protest-oriented, they are so powerful. So I think that what Sunrise has done is broken open the climate movement to be more about confrontational politics and not just inside baseball, polite policymaking that, quite frankly, will not get us where we need to go.
So I guess my next question would be, how does a group like Sunrise that has positioned itself as an outsider and had success doing it evolve? How do they change their tactics once politicians start listening to them?
Well, my view is that the environmental movement and the climate movement is really an ecosystem. And we have actors that play different roles. Just like in an ecosystem, you have different species. They live in different niches. They have different adaptations. And a lot of the times, we can argue about what's the best way to be, but there isn't one best way for an organization to be. What an organization needs to do is fit into the landscape of other organizations in the movement and find its niche. And it may be that the Sunrise Movement is really well placed to play an outside of Congress game where they're mobilizing people and making sure that there's pressure on politicians to pass a policy. And that's not some secondary bit player role. That is really the critical missing ingredient in climate action federally. When the Waxman-Markey bill was proposed in 2009, and Nancy Pelosi passed it through the House, but it stalled in the Senate, Theda Scotchbull, a Harvard researcher and professor, wrote a postmortem. She said, why didn't this pass? And What she argued is that there was no grassroots movement pushing to pass the law. And so Sunrise, I think, is going to play a really important role if and when we get an actual bill in Congress that is at the scale of the crisis, mobilizing people and putting pressure on politicians to pass that policy. And that's not some secondary thing. That is crucial. Then once that policy gets implemented, you know, we may need other groups to really pick up the ball. So we have legal groups like Earth Justice, for example, that hold the government accountable when they're not implementing laws correctly. We have groups like the Sierra Club that have a 50-state strategy to work at public utility commissions to shut down coal plants and make sure that clean energy is built. And not every organization is going to be staffed or resourced adequately to play all those parts in this ecosystem. So what we really need is coordination amongst all our work to make sure that we have all the players we need, but not that every organization plays every role.
What role do you think the Green New Deal has had in this ecosystem that you describe?
Yeah, the Green New Deal has catalyzed a new climate policy conversation, one that is focused more around the scale of the crisis, the benefits that are going to come from it, the role of government in the transition, and the central place for environmental justice. And where I think the Green New Deal has gone is it's developed into a conversation around three main principles. Standards, what are the rules of the road for the electricity sector, the transportation sector, buildings, heavy industry, agriculture. You know, where do we need to go and by when? Investments, centering government spending in this crisis, just like we would in a wartime mobilization, as the Green New Deal has pointed us towards, and justice, making sure that we're taking into account racial injustice and income inequality when we think about climate policy. And that standards investment justice approach is not really separate from this bigger conversation we've been having about the Green New Deal. It's just fleshing it out in more detail. And I think what that does is it focuses on solutions, opportunity, the scale of the crisis, jobs, benefits, justice. It's just a much more positive conversation than I think we would be having if we were still focused on kind of market-based solutions that are very consumer-facing, meaning people are going to pay for them through their electricity bills and their gas bills. My view is that right now with the pandemic, we have so many people across this country who are struggling to pay their electricity bills. A lot of people are being threatened with their utilities being cut off, which can be a life or death situation if you live in a really hot place like Arizona or a really cold place like the Northeast, where you need to heat your home. So turning off people's electricity is a terrible thing. But even if we don't shut off their electricity, what's happening is a lot of people are currently developing arrears. They have massive electricity bills that are just adding up month after month after month that they have fallen behind on. And we need to help people pay those electricity bills. And I don't think that given people do not make a living wage in this country, that we should base our climate solution on more consumer-facing costs, which make people's energy bills more expensive. I think we should take a government investment approach. And that is what the Green New Deal is all about. It's what the Standards Investment Justice Plan is about. And really, it's what the Biden campaign's climate agenda is about, too.
So can you tell us how you felt when you saw the election results come in?
On Wednesday morning, I watched this fantastic briefing from the Biden campaign, and it was a PowerPoint presentation. They showed, you know, how they were going to win in all these states, and it was completely logical, and it is what happened. And I just sobbed because I knew by Wednesday morning that we were going to have a change in leadership and that we were going to elect the first woman vice president ever, which is huge, and that, you know, we were going to have two climate champions in Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And I don't just say that for the sake of, I don't know what, rhetoric. I deeply believe that now. You know, I followed the primary just as much, if not more so, than a lot of other people in the climate movement. I don't know why, but it just became something I was doing. And I really watched Joe Biden's positions evolve. And I think the thing is that Joe Biden believes himself to be a climate champion. And it is true that he did sponsor the early legislation in Congress. He did steward $90 billion through the Recovery Act. And so that's his own view of himself. And I think he wasn't taking criticism well from the youth climate movement because it didn't comport with his own view of himself, which is that he does really care about this issue. And so I really believe that these people, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, care about climate change. So yeah, I'm really thrilled. I'm really thrilled that democracy gets to live another day, as AOC has put it. Yeah, it's a big, big deal that Biden and Harris won.
What would you say are the implications of this election for climate policy?
You know, the election was a huge win in terms of the presidency. But a lot of us were feeling on Tuesday night that there were also some losses. The Senate going the way that it did was pretty heartbreaking. So we have a problem, which is that Mitch McConnell, who seems to care more about the fossil fuel industry than Americans' lives, he's in charge of the U.S. Senate unless we manage to flip the Senate. And the good news is we still have a chance. First of all, they're still counting ballots in Alaska. We don't know how that's going to go. It's probably a long shot. But the closer shot, so to speak, is Georgia on January 5th. And I know a lot of the people who listen to this podcast, they're young, they're climate activists. And I would just really encourage people who are listening to get involved today. Ask yourself, can I go to Georgia sometime between now and January? There are wonderful organizations who are doing amazing work in Georgia, and you can plug into those efforts. So can you do phone banking? I know so many people in Sunrise were on the ground organizing and also doing phone banking. So, you know, climate legislation, our hope for climate legislation, it is on the ballot on January 5th in Georgia. And so this election is not over. Control of the Senate has not been decided. And if we really want to have transformative climate legislation in 2021, get involved. Do something now to help out in Georgia.
So, yeah, if Democrats don't manage to pick up these two seats that they need in Georgia in these runoff elections coming up in January to win control of the Senate, what could a Biden administration do without being able to pass new legislation?
You know, by Friday, a lot of us had our heads in executive action on climate. And the fact is that we have a lot of tools in the toolbox already. We have the Clean Air Act. And because of the Supreme Court ruling in Massachusetts versus EPA, the Clean Air Act legally must and can and should be used to regulate carbon dioxide because it poses an endangerment to Americans. So through the Clean Air Act, we can do things like put standards in place for our power sector in terms of how polluting they are. We can also allow California to go ahead and set its own air pollution standards for cars so that you know, they have cleaner air in California. And that's a big deal because California's car standards end up being not just the car standards for the entire United States, but also for Canada. You know, it kind of becomes the continental car standard. And in that way, it starts to become the global standard.
Last question, Leah. Looking forward, how are you feeling about what the climate movement has accomplished in this primary and election season, and what it can win going forward?
You know, this election was so long. It was a long primary, and then it was a long general election, and it has been a long week. So we're all pretty tired. But we should take a moment to pause and reflect on what we've achieved during this time. The climate movement is more powerful than it has ever been before. And that's because we have managed to break through. We have managed to influence the platforms of pretty much everybody running for president on the Democratic side. And we have managed to make climate change a top issue during the general election. And, you know, don't take that from me. Take it from Lisa Friedman writing in the New York Times about how maybe 5% or more of donors to Joe Biden were climate donors. Think about all the people who phone banked whether that was through clean energy for Biden or the Sunrise Movement or the Sierra Club or tons of other environmental groups, you know, these people phone banked for Biden and Harris and senators running, you know, for the Senate and local campaigns because of climate change. And, you know, Joe Biden, he wasn't just talking about this on the debate stage where he made really clear that he was planning to transition off of fossil fuels, which is a bold thing to do during an election in the United States of America. But the campaign also ran ads in Michigan and Arizona, in swing states, in key electoral battles that were about climate change. They ran climate ads on television. And I think that that just shows you that we are in a new era, you know? Yes, the planet is burning. The entire west coast of this country has been on fire this year, and we are into the Greek alphabet in hurricanes. And so it's really bad on the impact side. But when it comes to action, when it comes to movements, we are also winning. We are starting to break through. And so I'm really, really hopeful that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are deeply committed to this issue. They both mentioned it in their speeches on Saturday night when they were the president-elect and the vice president-elect. That was super exciting. Joe Biden, you know, he said so many times that this is his number one issue. If you want to feel pumped about the Biden-Harris situation, you know, go check out this short 1.5 minute video that Evergreen Action made. I literally just like watched it on a loop this weekend. It's so good. And it's just all these clips of Biden talking about climate change. And don't let anybody else tell you that like he doesn't care about climate change. Just go watch that clip and you will see that we have a shot. Yeah, we got to keep putting pressure. Yeah, we got to make sure that we got smart people in office, in the administration. Yeah, we got to really work hard to win the Senate in January. But we have an ally in the White House. And that is, it couldn't be more different than having a climate denier in the White House. So I am fired up. I am excited. And that's a hopeful place to be after 15 years of working on climate change.
Thank you for joining us on Generation Green New Deal Conversations, Leah. If you have one more minute, could you please just give us a quick pitch for your new podcast, A Matter of Degrees?
In the last month, we launched a new podcast called A Matter of Degrees. It's hosted by me and Catherine Wilkinson and produced by Stephen Lacey, who's awesome. He makes The Energy Gang and The Interchange, a lot of really fantastic climate podcasts. And we've released 5 episodes by now, and it's been super fun. We've gotten amazing feedback from people about it. You know, we tackle issues like, you know, is climate change an issue of personal responsibility or is it an issue of systemic change and polluters lying about the climate crisis for decades? And spoiler alert, in my view, it's the latter. And then, yeah, we just dropped a new episode this week, which is we're calling the Silver Linings Playbook, which is about why we should still feel hopeful about climate action, regardless of what happens in the Senate. So, yeah, it's been super fun starting this podcast. And, you know, we'd love for people to check it out, to leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts, and, you know, to tell your friends about it if you like it. Because, you know, just like this show, we're starting out, we're building a listenership, and, you know, we'd love to have more people tuning in and talking about the show.
Thank you so much, Leah.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This episode of Generation Green New Deal was produced by Tikkun Olam Films Incorporated and distributed by Critical Frequency. Thanks so much to Leah Stokes for joining us, and check out A Matter of Degrees wherever you get your podcasts. Also, wanted to let you know that this Friday, November 13th, we'll be doing a special online screening of the Generation Green New Deal film preview as part of the DC Environmental Film Festival's Fall Showcase. On Friday, starting at noon EST, you'll be able to watch the film for free, and then you can join a panel discussion with myself, producer Nate Birnbaum, and Mother Jones reporter Rebecca Lieber at 5 p.m. EST. To register for the screening, follow the link in the show notes or head over to dceff.org. Thanks for listening.